Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and as always, I like to start every podcast by thanking everyone who's been listening to My Classic Album, especially last month's episode dedicated to Queen's Sheer Heart Attack. That was a real labour of love for me. Sheer Heart Attack, my favourite album by my favourite band, Queen. It was great to finally cover Queen on the podcast, and Greg Hart from Cats in Space was an awesome guest, and it was just such a thrill to talk about Queen with a fellow Queen nut. Greg and I had a bit of a chat afterwards, and Greg's more than happy to come back on to talk about another album that he was torn between two, one being Sheer Heart Attack and the other being an album that's not by Queen, and I think that we'll probably revisit that sometime next year, so stay tuned for that. This year has been a fantastic year for My Classic Album, and I'm really excited as to how it's all gone over the past 12 months. You know, we started the podcast last year, but we've had some fantastic guests, some fantastic albums, and some fantastic anniversary specials. We've looked at albums such as Rumours and Bat Outta Hell that were released back in 1977, Hysteria released in 1987, and celebrated those anniversaries. We've had the likes of Ken Calais, who was engineer and producer for Rumours. We've had Ellen Foley, who sang with Meatloaf on Paradise by the Dashboard Light. And we've just had a phenomenal string of guests, including the likes of Beth Blade, Samantha Price, Mark Danzeisen, Rob Wild, Big Boy Bloater. I could go on. There's just so many. And I'd like to thank everyone who's tuned in this year. I'd like to thank all the guests who've taken time out of their schedules to join me. And here's to next year. Coming up in just a little bit, I'll be interviewing singer-songwriter Quint Starkey, who has chosen the debut album from Dire Straits to talk about today. And it's a really fascinating conversation, not just about kind of how Dire Straits and the Knopfler Brothers kind of got things off the ground, but how that relates to Quint and kind of his career and his growth as a musician. So that's coming up in just a little bit. And I'm also going to be having a quick look at The Corrs' latest album, Jupiter Calling. But before we get to all that, I just want to briefly touch on something that I was talking about last month. So, as I've just said there, fantastic year for My Classic Album. Some great albums, some great guests. And I just wanted to get a feel of kind of what you guys have enjoyed this year. What albums you listened to, which albums you've enjoyed, and which guests you've enjoyed listening to. So I put two questions up on the My Classic Album website. If you went to myclassicalbum.co.uk/poll, there were these two questions. The first one was out of all the albums that we've covered from December last year, which was Adrian Nation talking about Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind, right through to last month, which was Sheer Heart Attack, which of those albums would be your classic album of 2017? I also asked, out of all the guests that we've had talking about their classic albums, who do you think gave the most passionate argument that their album was the best album? So I just want to quickly let everybody know how that all went. So in terms of the classic album of 2017, and it was very close, I've got to say, because, you know, there's some fun, I mean, great albums that we've done this year. The album that you guys chose as your classic album of 2017 was Rumours by Fleetwood Mac. And I kind of wondered if it would be between kind of Rumours and Battle of Hell, because they were the two episodes that everybody really got excited about and really got behind, and Hysteria there as well. So congratulations to Fleetwood Mac, 40 years of Rumours, and the My Classic Album of the Year, 2017. As for the next question, which was, which guest do you think kind of gave the most compelling argument, the most passionate argument for why their album is a classic album? And that honour went to Rob Wild, who we had for Hysteria back in August. So congratulations, Rob. And I know that Rob is very keen to be back on the podcast, which again, we'll be doing at some point this year, talking about another album. Funnily enough, released in 1987. So there's a little clue for you. But another album that Rob would call his classic album. So that's Greg Hart and Rob Wild that you'll be hearing from again. So yeah, thank you very much to everyone who voted. And thank you very much to everyone who has listened over the past year. Once again, it's just such a great feeling, because this is very much just me hoping that somebody's going to listen. And, you know, people do. And I get great feedback all the time. So thank you very much. So before we dip into my chat with Quint Starkey, I just wanted to take a moment to touch on the latest album by The Corrs. So anyone who knows me will know that I'm a huge fan of The Corrs, and have been for a long time. And, you know, this bit where I kind of review albums and stuff and tours and this, that and the other, to be honest, they're very much going to be kind of bands and singers that I enjoy. And it's more of a recommendation than a review. I'm not likely to kind of recommend or talk about something that I think's rubbish. So, like I say, I've been a fan of The Corrs for a long time. And I must admit, I mean, in the late 90s, when I was kind of growing up, you know, they were all over, kind of live and kicking, and SMTV Live for people who are watching that sort of thing. They're a very photogenic family, you know, and they were riding high in the charts. Talk on Corners was like the best-selling album of 1998 or something. And I was absolutely in love with Andrea Corr. And it wasn't really until I bought an album that I, you know, I enjoyed that album. It was In Blue, I think, was the first Corr's album I bought, which had Breathless on it. And I was like, yeah, these guys are pretty good. I then went to see them on their Borrowed Heaven tour in 2004. And that was kind of when I realised that they're actually much more, you know, I think people look at them and they think they're a pop band in the vein of the other pop bands that were around at the time. And I know that some people really frustratingly get them mixed up with Bewitched, who were like a pretty popular Irish pop band at the time. But they were like a girl group, whereas the Corrs are like a family band. You know, they play their instruments, they write their songs, and they're just real phenomenal musicians and songwriters. So when I saw them live, that kind of flicked that switch for me, and I've been a huge fan of them ever since. And I've been lucky enough to see them two more times since that, since they returned a couple of years ago. So I saw them for their return gig at Hyde Park as part of BBC's Festival of the Day. And then I saw them at the O2 last January. And again, just it reinforced for me what a fantastic live band they are. And it's been exciting to see them kind of return. So they released White Light, which was at the back end of 2015, about this time. And I wondered, were they just going to do one album to see kind of how successful it was? And then it popped up that Jupiter Calling, their latest album, was coming out in November 2017. So, like many Corrs fans, I was very kind of anxious to hear it. And I think what's interesting, I really enjoyed White Light, but I think a lot of old-time Corrs fans thought that they were maybe trying to compromise with what was kind of going on in the music scene at the moment, maybe kind of a bit of an EDM influence, which you could hear at the start of that album, but I felt that by the end they were recording the kind of music that I would expect from them, the kind of music they wanted to play. Jupiter Calling is very much, it's an album, I wouldn't even say it's for the fans, it's for them. It's the music that they want to record, and as a result it comes across as a very kind of personal, raw album in some ways, which isn't necessarily something you would come to expect of the Corrs. One thing you could say for them is that, you know, a lot of it is quite polished at times and, you know, very poppy. And this is almost kind of, you know, they're older, they're in their 40s and 50s now, and they're thinking, well, we're going to record the music that we want to, because let's face it, you know, they're not likely to hit the top five of the album charts anymore. So why not record the music that you know the fans will enjoy and that you will enjoy recording? And that's exactly what they've done. And it's just a fantastic album. I hear some people saying it's kind of the best album they've put out. I don't know if I'd agree with that. It's certainly up there. It is a great album. A word that I've heard some people use to describe it is dark. And that's not really something that you could really kind of have accused the Corrs of being before. And perhaps in some ways it is. You know, some of the songs on the album, for them, are quite controversial. You know, I remember them saying that kind of when SOS was being released as a single, that it was the most controversial song they'd released. And, you know, in compared to something like Eminem or Kid Rock, it's not particularly controversial. But the band have always kind of had a political mind, and it's the first time that's really kind of bleeding into their music on a song like SOS, for example. Hit My Ground Running is probably the one that has stuck in my head throughout kind of repeated listens to the album. SOS, again, as well. I think, obviously, there's a reason why they kind of chose that to kind of promote the album. And Son of Solomon kind of has this, I think when people are talking about the album being a bit dark, that's kind of where it comes from. It's a very moody start for a Corrs album, when you think that previous ones have started with songs like Breathless and I Do What I Like and Summer Sunshine and songs like that. You know, Son of Solomon is quite, you know, it's quite a somber start to the album. And it just kind of shows you, you know, that this is a, you know, they're doing it now because they enjoy it. I think the last album was because they'd all had kids and they thought, we'd love to see our kids see what we did on stage. Now it's like, right, let's record the album that we want to record. We're not going to be promoting it on, you know, kids' TV on a Saturday morning. Let's record the album we want to record and see who buys it. And I've certainly bought it. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. But then again, I'm always going to have a soft spot for Andrea. So, yeah, take all that as you will. Because, you know, even my wife's kind of joked that there's three of us in this marriage. So, but yeah, Jupiter Calling by The Corrs is out now. Great album. Thoroughly recommended. Right, so I mean, I've kind of raced through that a little bit, but I'm excited to get to my interview with Quint Starkey, who has chosen the debut album from Dire Straits. So before we get to Quint, and we kind of get into what makes this album his classic album, here's everything you need to know. about Dire Straits. On the 7th of October, 1978, British rock band Dire Straits released their debut self-titled studio album. Dire Straits was released by Vertigo Records internationally and by Warner Brothers Records in the United States. Dire Straits were signed to Vertigo based on the popularity of a demo tape, which included the song Sultans of Swing, that had been played on Honky Tonk on BBC Radio London. The band recorded the album throughout February and March of 1978 in anticipation of their October release at Basing Street Studios in London. While other tracks on the album were released internationally, in the UK and US it was Sultans of Swing that was chosen as the single from the album. While its initial release in 1978 failed to gain much traction, its re-release in 1979 saw it become a hit on both sides of the Atlantic, charting at number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 8 on the UK singles chart. The success of the single not only made Dire Straits a household name, but made the song Sultans of Swing an iconic part of their setlist for years to come. The album did extremely well internationally, solidifying Dire Straits as one of the biggest bands in the world heading into the 1980s. The band saw particular success with the album in the United States and Australia, where it charted at number 2 and number 1 on their respective album charts. Back home in the UK, the album managed to reach number 5. This success saw the album reach platinum status in all three countries. Critically, the album has been held at a high standard and regarded as an accomplished debut for a band that would dominate the 1980s. Positive reviews from the likes of Rolling Stone followed, and a B rating from noted music critic Robert Christgau. So that's just the beginning of what we need to know about Dire Straits. And I have here with me a special guest who chose Dire Straits to talk about today. This is Quint Starkey. How's it going?
Hello there. It's going great, thanks. I'm here in Stockholm and it's freezing.
You have my deepest sympathies.
Cheers, mate.
Yeah, so let's just start at the very beginning. Why have you chosen Dire Straits and their first album to talk about today on My Classic Album?
Sure. I think it's the album that actually pointed me towards electric guitar. I learned classical guitar as a 12-year-old and was really into classical. So when most of my mates were listening to pop music, I was listening to it too, but I was listening to a lot of classical guitar players like Julian Bream and John Williams and Segovia. And then I heard, I think it was 16 when I heard Sultans of Swing in a pub on a jukebox, and it came from nowhere. I mean, it was just such a fresh sound at the time, especially as punk was rearing up at that time as well. So it was like a guitar player's dream to hear somebody playing. Not only was it great guitar playing, they were great songs too. So I mean, it really stood out. And then of course, I found out who it was and got the album and was even more delighted to realise that, you know, all the songs on the album were just as good as Sultans of Swing almost. So that's where it started.
Absolutely. I mean, that it's always great when you can kind of remember that moment when you kind of heard a song or an album for the first time. And it sounds like that's something that's really kind of vivid for you. We'll talk a bit as well about kind of this kind of almost pub rock genre that they've been somewhat thrown into. What was that like for you? Like, it seems, like I say, a very vivid memory for you for that first time.
It is. I remember the pub. It was in Blackburn, actually, and I don't think the pub's still there anymore. I think it's, you know, fallen victim to the times and it's gone. But the great thing for me with Martin Opler was that he used his fingers, and playing classical guitar, it was just such an easy transition to try and pick out his licks, you know. So, I mean, I went basically from sitting on a stool with a footrest playing classical guitar to standing at my bedroom window listening to, you know, trying to rip off his licks. And I got pretty good at it pretty soon because I used my fingers more than a pick. So it was really, really easy to adapt. And I mean, the guy is, I mean, since then, obviously he didn't know at the time he was going to write so much great music, but just, you know, it had everything. It had taste, it had great lyrics, it had a catchy tune, it told a story. You know, I think it's one of the best singles of all time, probably.
So Dire Straits are one of the most successful bands of all time. They're multi-time Grammy Award winners. They've spent over 1,100 weeks on the UK album charts as of a few years ago, and they've sold over 100 million albums. Other than obviously hearing Sultans of Swing and that kind of life-changing moment, why does their debut album particularly stand out to you as opposed to, say, Brother in Arms?
Well, obviously, the first time you hear something is always special because it's you know, you've no reference before. Like it came from nowhere at the time. I was listening to people like, I think, if I remember time wise, 10cc. There was a band called Sad Cafe from Manchester. Who else would I be listening to then? ELO. You know, the even before that, maybe Mud and Sweet and Slade and all those bands. But being a guitar player, I think it just appealed to me straight away because it had that great Strat sound. To be honest with you, I'm not such a huge fan of Brother in Arms. I loved the first three or four albums when he was using his Strat. And then when he went over to a Les Paul, it kind of, even though they're great songs, I mean, don't get me wrong, I just love that Strat thing. And then the other thing I like about his songs, he tells stories. You know, there's always a concept behind each song. So, you know, when it starts, that album starts with Down to the Waterline, and you hear that bell in the beginning, and you can almost see yourself stood at some harbour on a cold night with, like, you know, smoke bellowing and stuff. He just paints such a good picture with his music. So I think that's why. And then, you know, he had the Strat, he had the Dobros. He had a lot of sounds. You didn't hear much Dobro unless you were listening to country, but he managed to put it into pop. And I just think the album is so strong as a body of work. You know, there's so many great songs on there. And, you know, Sons of Swing doesn't pop up till track six, so that just shows you the faith he had in the other stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, I guess hearing the statistics I was talking about and the praise that were heaping on the album, you're reminded of what a huge band they were. I'm actually from Durham, so that's not far away from Blythe, where the Knopflers grew up. He's very much a local hero. Do you think, because their time together was relatively short compared to many other established bands, that they may be sometimes overlooked in the new millennium?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, they were a band. I mean, I remember when they lost, or fired, maybe, I don't know what the right word is, but when Pick Withers, the drummer, disappeared, I think you could tell there was a big change in the sound a little bit, because he was such an important part. The drumming on Sultans of Swing is just, you know, the whole record, the whole album is amazing. You know, they lost me a little bit when they started doing stuff like Walk of Life. You know, it got a bit too stadium rock pop thing, you know. The great thing about these songs, I think they're not written from a perspective of having a hit. They're just written from writing good songs, you know. And I think he got into a little bit of a phase where he tailored the stuff for the stadiums. I always remember seeing him here in Stockholm, actually, and when they were mega successful, they'd probably done Brothers in Arms and all the other big hits, big albums. And I remember him saying, it's a huge stadium, like 30,000 people, "How are you doing on the left? All right, how you doing on the right? All right, how you doing at the back?" And it just seems so, like, you know, he's done this a million times. His heart wasn't in it. Whereas when he did Dire Straits, the first album, he must have been so hungry. And, you know, I mean, he had no idea they were going to be so successful. But I just like the idea that, you know, if maybe that guy Charlie Gillett, the DJ, hadn't heard the demo, you know, if he hadn't played it on his radio show, we might not be having this conversation today, because, you know, the album might never have come out.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, the sound, as I kind of touched on earlier, is often thrown into this genre dubbed pub rock. It arose in the 70s in the UK as a reaction against the bombast of kind of the rock bands, some of the other rock bands you were talking about of the day, like 10cc and ELO and The Sweet. In some ways, it was almost an offshoot of punk in ethos, if not in sound. Anir Roy of ManipleTheTalk.org says that Dire Straits strayed from the fast-paced, almost aggressive music and commemorated their own brand of a minimalistic, stripped-down sound. Considering the other music that we've been talking about that was around in the late 70s, do you think the Dire Straits were blazing their own trail with this, for lack of a better term, kind of a pub rock sound?
Absolutely. I mean, guys like Knopf, they don't come around that often, you know. I mean, he's doing his own thing. There was no one else doing... I mean, obviously, I can see his influences. I mean, you've got to mention people like... J.J. Cale and people like that he's obviously listened to, but he took it so far. And like I said, the thing that stands out for me, I don't think he was trying to have a hit. He was just trying to write good songs, you know. And that's the big difference when you look at the the Muds and the Swedes, because they were basically producing 3-minute pop hits. And I'm not too clued up on their albums, but, you know, as a body of work, I think this one is very cohesive, and all the songs sound like they fit and were written at the same time. And he did his own thing because, you know, who else played guitar like that at the time? Nobody. And that's a pretty brave thing to do, to just, you know, do your own thing. Because the great thing about doing your own thing, if you're successful, you'll be very successful. Whereas if you're copying someone else, you know, maybe you won't achieve that kind of success.
Allmusic.com theorized that one thing that set Dire Straits apart from other bands in this kind of pub rock movement was a sense of melancholy in the songs. And we could possibly attribute this to Mark Knopfler's situation in the early days, going through a divorce and desperate to make it as a musician. Do you hear that kind of melancholy element in the music of Dire Straits?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing for me is he paints such vivid pictures. You know, like when he's talking about Portobello Road, I can almost see myself sat in a cafe like he is, looking out the window and stuff like that. You know, it's so vivid and so well crafted. And I think, I mean, speaking from my own point of view, I made a solo album last year. It's been out now about a year. And before, I used to write songs for, I was signed to EMI, writing for artists. And you're making stuff up. There's no truth in what you're writing, because it's, you know, you're writing pop music. Whereas when I did my own album, I just wrote purely from experience and things that have happened to me. And it's a lot easier. And I think, like, when Knopfler was going through his divorce, that's when you get the material. That's when you get the ideas. And you have things you want to get off your chest and say. And there's no better way of saying it than in a song form. You know, it makes the songs much easier to write, because the material's already there. You're not trying to imagine things.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dire Straits kind of begins with this collaboration between Mark and his brother David. Mark had to move in with his brother following his divorce, as he was struggling financially. And it was David's flatmate, John Ilsley, who also got in on the ground floor as the band's bass player. So other than Mark, John was the only member of Dire Straits to stay with the band to the very end. Just how integral was John to Dire Straits and the sound that they would develop over the years?
I think, besides the sound, I think you always need someone in a band that you can ask questions. You know, when you write stuff, you always need someone you can say, what do you think about this? You know, you always need that other side of the coin kind of thing, because if especially as a solo artist, it's so easy to just disappear up your own you know what. It's always great to have a shoulder to lean on, and I think the problem with his brother was they were two of the same kind. You know, I think they both wanted to be leaders, and you know, obviously, you know, because you can see from how much material David released over the years that he had a lot to say and a lot of music inside him. So I think John probably served not only as a part of the sound, but as a part of the keeping Mark on the right track and being a soundboard for you know, the music and maybe decisions that they took as a band, touring and whatever.
And then we've touched on Pick Withers already. He completed the lineup on drums, and I mean we'll go into Pick a little later on, because there's been some, as you said before, some fantastic praise for his drumming on this album. The band scraped enough money together to record a demo tape, which included Sultan's The Swing, that would, of course, appear in a more polished form on this album. Has that demo version ever been released to the public in any form? Have you heard it or anything like that?
I haven't heard it, actually. I don't think I've heard it. But I know with the event of, you know, the Spotify, sometimes those things tend to surface on Spotify, but I haven't seen it. And to be honest with you, I'm not part of any, like, underground Dire Straits movement, so I'm sure some guy out there has probably got it. And I remember that Bohemian Rhapsody has been circulating with, you know, like a Pro Tools session with all the tracks separate. And I would love to get my hands on Sultans of Swing if I could, but not that I know of, no. But I would imagine that, I think the thing that tends to happen with bands like Dire Straits is the demo probably sounded very similar to what actually came out, because I think they recorded everything pretty much live as a band, and with very few overdubs, so who knows.
So the band approached DJ Charlie Gillis, who we were talking about earlier, to get his opinion on their demo, but then he in fact liked it so much that he played Something to Swing on his show Honky Tonk that Sunday. By the time the song had finished, his studio was inundated with calls from half of the A&R men in London. Dire Straits were on their way to global success, and they never forgot their debt to his willingness to trust his instincts. But for me, that's just an unbelievable story about how any band can be on the precipice of fame at any moment. And like you said, if that hadn't happened, we might not even be having this conversation.
Exactly. I mean, there's so many stories like that. You know, the Swedish band Roxette, they were only discovered because somebody had a cassette in their pocket at university in California and played it on a university radio station. That was the same effect. I mean, moving to London, which Knopfler did, was obviously step number one. I mean, at that time, it was like, if you're going to make it, you've got to go to London. And I guess it's changed a little bit now because the industry's not set up the same way with all the record companies. I mean, with the internet, you can be pretty much anywhere in the world and still have a shot at it. But I think, and the other thing is, back then, I would imagine that Charlie's radio show, there wasn't that much competition in terms of, you know, there was Top of the Pops on TV and maybe a few music shows. You know what I mean? There wasn't that much. Now we're surrounded by media, internet and blah, 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 and streaming and blah, blah, blah. There's so much going on. Whereas back then, I think you had a much more focused audience, and this probably was just what some people wanted to hear, you know, at the time. It was perfectly at the right, you know, came at the right time.
And obviously, as a result of all that, Dire Straits was signed to Vertigo Records on the strength of the reaction of Something to Swing. And the album was released by October 1978 to great commercial and critical plaudits, including Grammy nominations, top 10 success, etc. What is it about this collection of songs? And I know we've touched on how things changed. Why do you think they resonated so strongly at that point for everybody?
I think one of the reasons is, you know, sometimes people make albums and they're timeless. There was a lot of music that came just after this in the 80s that was very focused or produced with technology. And that technology, it like put a date stamp on the music. So when you listen to it today, you know, you hear all the Lindrums and the synths and the stuff. And it's whereas if you listen to this, it's a very organic album. And you can't really date it as to when it was recorded because all the instruments are real. There's no synths, there's no drum machine on this. And I think that gave it that timeless quality. And the songs, you know, even to this day, they're still relevant in terms of their message and what he was trying to say.
So now seems as good a time as any to go track by track. So we'll, you know, we've said some fantastic songs on this album, so let's kind of get into each one. We'll start with Down to the Waterline. Obviously our first track on the album, and indeed for some people back in the late 70s, this could have been their first introduction to Dire Straits, if not Something to Swing. Author Joe McNally commented on the atmospheric start to the song, saying that the band appears out of the fog to get things started. How does this song kick the album off for you, and do you agree with that analogy of this idea of them kind of emerging through the fog?
Absolutely. I think you can see that kind of intro on. I'm trying to think how the other albums started, but I think the track Telegraph Road started in a similar way. It was just like an atmospheric intro, and it gives you time to kind of feel where you are. And then, of course, when the lyrics kick in, and you know, he's talking about being on the quayside and running high. That's another thing that Knopfler did a lot. I think he had a great memory of his childhood and his maybe his teenage years and growing up. And there's loads of references in his songs to, and he makes references that everyone can relate to. You know, I mean, we all went to the fun fair and we all rode on, you know, dodgems and all that kind of stuff. And I think with this track, you know, that bell in the beginning, and it's just genius. It's just great. And that, I mean, at the time, who came up with that? You don't know. Maybe the producer said, "Why don't we, you know, make it sound like you're actually at the harbor or something?" It could have been a producer's call, but because I've always thought myself that you've got to be careful with sound effects because it's really easy to be cheesy. But this just sounds like everything should be there, and it's great. I love it.
And, you know, you talk about this idea of him, kind of these memories of his teenage years. Mark and David have both commented in the past that the song recounts Mark walking along the banks of the River Tyne at night with his girlfriend. So we've talked a bit about an element of melancholy in some of Dire Straits' work, and that'll come in later in the album, but I'm guessing you'd agree with me there's also an element of kind of reflection and looking back on times gone by, like we have here with Down to the Waterline.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, that is, obviously there's loads of melancholy in his stuff, but for me, he's very good at recalling memories, and but not only his memories, that kind of make him feel like you remember the same kind of thing too. I mean, that's how many guys and girls didn't, you know, walk along a riverbank with a girlfriend at one time, a boyfriend, or drive in a car somewhere, or pull outside a cafe and, you know, park up and listen to the radio, or all these songs have got that kind of stuff in it, and I guess, you know, we can all identify with it. I think that's why they're so successful, because he's writing about stuff that, you know, me and you, everybody's been through, and it's and when he's talking about his girlfriend, the song kind of reminds us of our girlfriends or boyfriends or whatever, you know what I mean? So it's like it's a universal theme that just is put over with such a great framework and craft, you know, in the songs. That's another thing about music. I always find music to be like a musical diary, if you will. When you hear a song, it's like you said, when I heard Sons of Swing for the first time, I can see the jukebox, I can see the pub. It's just like etched in my memory, you know, through sound, which is amazing, really.
So Down to the Waterline was released in some countries as the B-side to Water of Love. Kerry Darling of Billboard magazine had a lot of praise for Down to the Waterline back in January 1979. And one interesting opinion he had is that he believed the song superior to its A-side. Do you have a preference between Down to the Waterline and Water of Love? Of course, we'll be talking about Water of Love very shortly.
Sure. I mean, the thing for me, you've got to remember, I'm a guitar player. So, like, when he kicks off that song with the solo, he does a little rundown at the end, which goes like ticka 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 tick tick with his fingers. And when I heard that for the first time, that was just like, you know, I could play that phrase with a vinyl moving the needle backwards and forwards. You know, I could do that for hours trying to figure out what he did. So not only were the songs like Water of Love is a pretty slow song, and it's got that great driving, well, not driving, but real laid back groove that you know, just so as long. Whereas with Down to the Waterline, it was the guitar playing that really drew me towards that song more than Water of Love. I think I appreciate Water of Love more now in my later years than I did at the time. But Down to the Waterline just had such great guitar playing. And he's so good at setting up guitar solos as well. I mean, obviously with Sultans of Swing, but he really knows how to set up a, you know, a platform for his guitar playing. And I just thought the guitar playing on Water of Love was... So at the time, that would definitely be a preference towards instead of Water of Love, for sure.
It seems like a good time for us just to jump to Water of Love. And it's one of several songs on the album that's about failed relationships. So in the 1984 book Dire Straits, author Mike Oldfield claimed that the track could be about the breakdown of Mark's marriage. Is this the start of that kind of sense of melancholy that we've been talking about quite a bit so far?
I guess so. You know, I never really got into his private life, so I didn't really understand probably what the songs were about. Just it was like a universal theme of, you know, maybe rejection or a relationship falling apart. Because, like I say, I think you tend to base your perception of songs on your own experiences. And like I said, there's nothing better than sometimes you got to go through the bad times to get the great songs, you know, because that's when your emotions are, you know, working overtime, throwing out all these ideas and lyrics. And but I mean, you know, how many songs can we count that have that theme? You know, Romeo and Juliet, there's so many. They're, you know, the guys had a colourful love life or romantic life, that's for sure.
And it's funny you should talk about lyrics, because there's a particular lyric in this song that I was struck by, and it seems I'm not the only one. So in his book My Life in Orange, Tim Guest recalls listening to Water of Love as a child, hiding behind a sofa, and the lyric, "Water of love deep in the ground, but there ain't no water here to be found, resonating so strongly with him, he wished that the water of love would come to him someday.
Sure, that's what I mean about universal themes. I mean, it's that can apply to everybody, you know. That is the hard thing with writing songs sometimes, that if you get too personal or too deep into your own thing, you know, people maybe don't relate to it. And the other great thing about that song is it's got such a melodic, strong melody. So it's, you know, sometimes you can sing along with songs you have no idea what you're singing, you know, especially today. But that obviously that's such a clever lyric, and that's the hard thing too about writing songs, to touch on these universal themes, but using very simple formula, or not formula, that's the wrong word, very simple metaphors. And he's amazing at that.
I mean, interestingly, Water of Love is one of a number of songs that Knopfler's publisher made country demos of without his approval. And this led to many country versions of this song in particular. But it's funny because I felt, before I knew that, while listening to it, that there very much was a country vibe to this song. And you kind of discussed a little bit that you feel there are some country influences that kind of come into this album.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, from a guitar playing point of view, I mean, I'm pretty sure that, you know, Mark knows every J.J. Cale song from back in the day when he was popular. And but I mean, I know how Mark can play, having grown up with his playing. So, I mean, he plays a lot of Chet Atkins stuff. And, you know, Chet is about as Nashville as you can get. And a lot of the stuff on, when you get into playing these songs on the album, maybe not the Sultans of Swing one, but if you take a song like Lions, for instance, or In the Gallery, there's a lot of country influence. And then Setting Me Up, of course, is you know, there's a lot of country picking going on there. So I think he comes from that, he's taken a lot of country style guitar playing and added his own sense of melody. He's a very melodic player. I mean, you know, the Sultans of Swing solo has got to be it's got to be in the top 10 up there with like Hotel California, and for me anyway, Stairway to Heaven and all these classic solos that just, you know, it's the test of a good solo is when you play it as a cover and you can't improvise, you have to play the original, otherwise it won't work. And that's, you know, that's Dire Straits and the Eagles and all these bands that just write such great melodic stuff. I don't know if I answered your question there, but
no, I'm sure you did. I mean, obviously you were talking about Setting Me Up there. Another one of the country demos recorded without his knowledge. So what is it? I mean, obviously there is that kind of country influence coming in, but lyrically, do you think that kind of the type of subject matter that he's writing about lends itself well to kind of country renditions?
Yeah, I mean, he's writing about relationships for the most part. And I mean, you know, the old joke in the music business is what you get if you play a country music record backwards. You know, you get your wife back, you get your house back, you get your dog back, you get, it's all relationships. Yeah, I think it lends itself very well to that. Now, I can understand him maybe not being too fond of, his songs being cut by a lot of country artists because, you know, maybe they water down the original in some way, that there's, you know, hundreds of versions out there. Maybe not, I don't know, but he certainly didn't need to do it for any financial interest, that's for sure.
So while this one was never released as a single by Dire Straits, Setting Me Up was covered by country band Highway 101 and released by them in the US and Canada, where it actually charted in the top 10 in both countries. Do you think that perhaps Dire Straits missed a trick not releasing this one as a single when they had the chance?
I think you've got to ask yourself what was he aiming for, Knopfler? Did he want number ones, or did he want to make good records and be respected as a musician, which he certainly achieved? But I don't know. I mean, looking at what they did and achieved, I don't think they really made any wrong decisions along the way. I mean, they got it to stadium rock and toured the world, you know, year after year doing the big stadiums. I'm sure he, at the end, he was, like I was saying about him saying, are you okay on the left? Are you okay on the right? How are you doing at the back? I'm sure he longed for playing somewhere like Dingwalls or some small club, you know, with a sweat dripping off the walls where you could see the eyes of everyone in the audience and stuff like that. In the end, because, I mean, that's where they started, and that's probably the great times they look back on. You know, sometimes the success and the size of the operation can maybe make it feel like you've lost part of the original reason you got into it for, you know. Because I'm sure he didn't get into it for thinking, well, if we record these songs, lads, you know, one day we'll be touring the world non-stop. Just watch, you know. I mean, obviously there's a dream there, but I'm sure that was not the reason for him, you know, starting the band. And I think they just wanted to play songs and, you know, if they get on top of the pops, that'd be great. But then they wrote some, you know, he wrote some amazing stuff. And he proved he could do it album after album. You know, I think the albums grew as time went on.
So that's Quint Starkey there talking with me about Dire Straits' self-titled debut album, and we'll be back with Quint in just a little bit. Coming up, why did Mark Knopfler initially have an issue with Sultans of Swing? Plus, how does a track like Lions resonate in today's society? All that and more right after this.
They'd never done anything like this album before, ever. There was such a mix of stuff on it.
Would you like to get involved with the discussion on my classic album? Or maybe you'd like to be a guest on a future episode?
I don't think there's any other album that is so poignant and so human in its lyrics.
Like us on Facebook by searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Alternatively, you could follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or even tweet us over at MCA_podcast.
This music is inside of me, and I couldn't not be influenced by it if I tried.
But at the time, it blew my mind, and it blew millions of people's mind, and that's why it's my classic record.
Make sure you never miss an episode and keep up to date with all the latest news at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk.
Why is whatever people say I am, that's what I'm not, your classic album, and why should people check it out?
It was amazing, that's why.
And I mean, our next track, Six Blade Knife, is another great example. It's New Zealand-based website Stuff that has a lot of praise for this particular song, and the author singles out drummer Pick Withers as the star of the album and comments that on this track his brushes are like a great Mick Fleetwood performance. That's really bold praise when you consider that, you know, late 70s, Mick Fleetwood was probably one of the biggest musicians in the world at that point, and Pick Withers was just starting out.
Absolutely. I mean, the, Rumours, what an album. I mean, that's, you know, probably one of the best albums of all time. And to be compared to Mick Fleetwood, sure. You know, Mick Fleetwood had been around, when did he start? He started early 60s, I think, with all the,
yeah,
you know, various bands, so sure.
But then I guess, you know, we're saying what a big album Rumours is. You know, we covered Rumours earlier this year on My Classic Album. So obviously Dire Straits is, you know, it has to be in that conversation simply because it's, you know, the podcast is about classic albums and here we are a few months later talking about Dire Straits. So, yeah. With all that in mind, how does Pick rank amongst those kind of the great drummers in music history for you?
I mean, I have basically a couple of albums as a reference for him. So, all I can say is that what he played on this album was the first Dire Straits album was just perfect. It was just, you want a drummer that drives along the songs but doesn't get in the way. It's Phil's coming for the reason of now I'm going to put a fill in just because I can play, you know. 50 paradiddles and in a row. It's just everything's done with such taste, and that's what I look for in drummers when I play them. I don't want anyone who's flashy. I just want someone who can, you know, play a good groove and play what the song needs. And I think, when you record an album and you're stood in the studio and you're listening to the final mixes, you know, I think they must have said to themselves, you know, this is perfect. This is great. You know, let's leave it. Don't touch it, because there's always that urge to well, what if we just try this or just do that? And, you know, it's like a piece of string. If you change the bass, then all of a sudden the drums sound wrong. And if you change the drums, the bass sounds wrong. And, you know, so I think they probably stood at the back of the studio when they finally mixed it and thought, let's go down the pub, guys. This is great.
There's been a lot of discussion over the years around the lyrics to Six Blade Knife, with many people suggesting that the Six Blade Knife in question is in fact Mark's guitar, and that it opens him up emotionally and tears him apart, but he can't live without it.
Yeah.
I mean, can you kind of relate to that feeling yourself as a musician? I know you've said, obviously, what an influence kind of Mark's music's had on you over the years.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know that, actually, but it does make sense when you mention it. I mean, if you look at what you can achieve with just a guitar, it's pretty remarkable, really. You know, you start off in your bedroom imitating your idols, and you learn songs, and then you make that. I still have the first set list, actually, that I ever played in a band. It was in a pub called The Shoulder of Mutton in Oswald Twistle, and I still have it, and it's like a little, it's not even an A4, it's smaller than A4, and it's like lined letter paper, and it's got beer stains on it and stuff. And I think the first song we ever played was 8 Days a Week by Beatles, and then the second song was Sultans of Swing, which just shows what I was, you know, probably, I don't remember if I did play the solo on that or the other guy in the band did. He had a very good ear, so he probably did at the time. I mean, from my own, you know, I come from Accrington, and I did work for 6 years. I did an apprenticeship in engineering, and after I graduated, I did City and Guilds, and after I'd finished my apprenticeship, I said to the guys, I said, look, I'm going to take off my guitar now. I've got a professional gig. Here's my toolbox, here's my overalls, just look after them, because I'm probably going to be back. And that was in 1984 or 85. And I've never touched a toolbox since then. I've only touched my guitar. So I mean, it's taken me around the way. It took me to Los Angeles, and there I met my wife, and ended up relocating to Sweden. And I've played guitar since that day, basically. It's been my livelihood. And it's, you know, and that, and my story is really weird, because when people say, what inspired you to play guitar? I'd love to say it was Mark Knopfler or it was Jimi Hendrix. It's the classic answer, you know, I saw Jimi Hendrix, but I actually saw a kids' TV show called Junior Showtime, and it was just like three kids sat on stools strumming classical guitars, and I just said to my mum, I want to play guitar, and my dad came home from work, and she told him, and he said, okay, I'll buy you a guitar if you take lessons, and he bought me a 5 quid nylon string guitar and found me a teacher, and that was it, I was off. And I've been playing ever since. So I mean, the six blade knife, it's a great metaphor for you know, the tool. Sure.
And it's really interesting that you kind of talked about your journey there, because moving on to our next song, Southbound Again, you know, it is kind of the emotions that can be triggered from kind of moving away or working away from where you are. Obviously, you know, Mark came from the Northeast. He moved down to London in those efforts to find success.
That's right.
And that can, you know, we've talked on My Classic Album in the past about how that can trigger both positive and negative experiences. But it sounds like for you, that was a really positive experience.
I mean, I come from Accrington, and they have a song on my album. The first song is called Where I Belong. And I kind of tell the story about how I remember it in the 60s and 70s, and it was a really nice market town and busy and vibrant. And now, unfortunately, it's a really it's run down, and there's a lot of unemployment. It's really sad to see it in that state. And I've never had the urge, actually, to move home. I feel like I'm, I don't know, it sounds like a cliche, not on a journey, but just I've always wanted to play and, you know, follow my gut feeling and my heart. And I don't think I could have done what I've done in my musical life staying in Accrington. I mean, I've had a great career writing stuff for TV and film and, you know, adverts music wise and I've done that for 20 years, and it's only recently I made the album, thanks to Francis Dunnery playing a gig at my house here in Stockholm and saying, he saw that I had a studio in my house. He said, hey, you're a muso, you should make an album. And then he called me 6 months later. I said, how's it going? And I said, I haven't started, mate. He said, right, I'll come and sit with you for 6 days and get you going. Just send me every song you've written. And when he said that, I thought, Jesus, what, you know, I mean, Francis is an old idol of mine. I've, you know, followed him from It Bites. And, so I thought, oh, I've got to do something. So I wrote literally 14 songs in like 6 weeks. And I'd write one and send it to him, and then we'd Skype and discuss it and stuff. And he just kept saying, yeah, it's great, keep going. Write another one. So that's how that came about. And then, you know, once I set off, I left Accrington, and my first professional gig was with an English dance band that came from Blackpool. We played like 6 nights a week, 5 sets a night, toured Germany and Norway. And it was while I was on that tour that I read about this school in America in California called GIT, Musicians Institute. So I decided to send off a demo cassette and audition tape, and luckily I got in there, and that was it. I was destined never to return to Accrington again, I think. You know, just visiting my family now and then. But that's the great thing about music. You know, it can take you out of somewhere, and, you know, take you on a journey that's just amazing. And I mean, I feel very privileged that I've been able to, you know, survive and work with it for 25 years. So, the other great thing is releasing an album now in my old, grand old middle age. You know, I don't have any expectations of, you know, getting on Top of the Pops if it still existed, or, you know, selling a million albums. I'm just doing it because I really love writing songs and producing songs and, you know, playing music. And my goal with the album is to you know, be able to tour with it. And if I can get a few more tours set up, that'd be fine. But, you know, then it's if not, no problems. I've had a great time recording it and, you know, working with all the musicians. And again, I don't know where this is going to be aired or whatever, but I really want to say thanks to Francis Donnery for, you know, without him it wouldn't have happened. And he's been amazingly supportive and helping. And he played a great solo on one of the tracks as well. So I can't thank him enough for that.
Cool. So our next track on the album is Sultans of Swing, almost the elephant in the room.
Yep.
it's perhaps the song that we all associate with Dire Straits. And as we've said, it's this undisputed classic rock staple. Yet initially, Mark didn't think much of the riff. He told Guitar World magazine in 2008, "I thought it was dull. But as soon as I bought my first Strat in 1977, the whole thing changed. Mm. But the lyrics remained the same. It just came alive as soon as I played it on that 61 Strat, which remained my main guitar for many years. It was basically the only thing I played on the first album, and the new chord changes just presented themselves and fell into place." Mm. You talked before about kind of how the guitar that he plays on these albums is a big part of what makes them such great.
Absolutely, yeah, sure. I mean, if it had used a Les Paul on Sultans of Swing, I don't think it would have been as successful. It's hard to say that, you know, it's speculation, but there's just something about that out-of-phase Strat sound that me and a million other guitar players, you know. And that's the other thing about guitar players. Like, someone releases a track like Sultans of Swing, you can imagine what the sales figures were like for Fender at that time. You know, everyone had run out and bought a red Strat, and he just were very, you know, a lot of musicians are never happy with their sound. They're always searching for the next thing. And there's a part of the romance of seeing someone like Knopfler, who also felt like this, because I remember him saying that he used to go and stare in the shop window at this red Strat that he couldn't afford at the time, and, you know, still living with his parents, I think. And something about when he got his first Strat, he remembered opening the case, and he said he can still remember the smell of the guitar. And that's something I always think about when I buy guitars, or, you know, you open the case, and first thing I do, I smell them. I don't know if it's because of Knopfler, but, you know, there's that romance to... And that was the other thing, you know, a 61 Strat, you know, that's like a lot of people's dream guitar. You know, most of us will never ever be able to afford one because they cost, you know, fortunes now. But But I think the guitar for that song was crucial. And like you say, if it inspired him to complete the song, then I think the answer is right there.
And what I loved is when you were talking about hearing Sultans of Swing for the first time, and you talked about how you'd kind of heard it in the pub, and kind of how almost happenstance that is, because the reason the song came about was because he had seen a band in the pub who'd come out looking really kind of dowdy and not particularly ready for the occasion, but they were called the Sultans of Swing. and how that kind of juxtaposition of their appearance and their name kind of yeah. triggered something in him to yeah. write the song.
Yeah. I mean, it's the other thing, being a muso, and I would imagine every muso listening, whoever listened to this, will associate with, is that feeling of, you know, I did a gig recently in a place in Lyme in Cheshire, and the night before I played with Francis up in Egremont, and you know, with a full band, and there were people who had come to this charity gig from all over the world, and there were a few people who I told them, I said, I'm playing tomorrow night in Lyme if you want to come by. And there were a couple from Germany who booked an extra hotel night to come and see it. And there were a few regulars that have seen me there 3 or 4 times before. But the pub had changed hands. And when I got there, it was like absolutely packed. And it was a Sunday, it was supposed to be really quiet. And as soon as I walked to the door, someone shouted, "Hey, your singer's here." And I thought, this is not really what I was expecting, because I play my own stuff, you know, and it's supposed to be like a sit down. So the pub was kind of divided by the time I started playing. On the left, I had all the people who come to see me play, who listened to every word, and on the right, I had a lot of people that weren't interested for, you know, 2 cents, and just spoke and laughed and, you know, paid no attention. And I think that's probably what Knopfley saw when he, you know, and every musician has experienced this, when you stood up there and nobody's paying you any attention whatsoever, and you just need to rise above it. And I, to be fair, the guys who come from Germany, I could see the look on their faces, thinking, you know, we want to hear this and we can, and blah blah. So in my second set, I said to them, I said, hey guys, to the rowdy crowd, I'm going to play some of my own stuff now. It'd be great if you could listen for 5 minutes and, you know, so give it a chance. And it worked out pretty good, so I got them on my side. But I think that's what Knopfler's, you know. You know, check out Guitar George. Who actually, I know who Guitar George is now, actually, because I recorded on a boat in Wales, and this guy George, I don't remember his last name, but he's quite well known, a great character, and obviously, I think he's from round Leeds, so I think Knopfler probably met him when he was working for the Yorkshire Post or the newspaper there. But that, you know, check out Guitar George. He knows all the chords. And Harry doesn't mind, you know, all that stuff. He's talking about musos that are just doing their thing, you know. And the guys coming in out of the rain to hear the jazz go down, you know. Well, we'd rather keep dry, listen to some jazz, you know, stay outside and get wet kind of thing. That's the only reason they're in there. There's so many great lyrics in that song. It's just, and I can identify with them all because, you know, it's tough. I mean, I've been to gigs where, you know, big artists, where you find people just ignoring the artist and talking, and you think, why did you come to the gig? You know, if you're not going to listen, why do you? You know, I remember seeing the Eagles, and it had been great, and they were playing Hotel California, and it was an outdoor festival, and just when it came to the solo, two Finnish guys who were absolutely paralytic stood up and started to like sing the solo as he played it, you know, two semitones out of tune or something. It's like, guys, you know, I've waited all my life for this moment, and you just ruined it, you know. So, Sultans of Swing is just a reflection of, you know, the experience of maybe playing small places where, you know, people don't pay attention. And having said that, you know, to be honest, I have a friend. He was a session guy in Manchester, and he told me about his mate who was looking for a guitar player, or maybe, I think Knopfler was looking for a second guitar player when he lived in Leeds. So this guy goes over and he meets Knopfler, and Knopfler plays him some of his songs. And this guy turned him down. He said, "Nah, I don't think it's for me, mate." He didn't believe in Knopfler's material, you know. I guess it's like a Pete Best story. The guy's probably kicking himself now, but yeah, he didn't see it, you know. And So and that's the other thing. You need someone like Charlie Gillett who recognizes the potential in songs. You know, I have a really weird scenario now. Like, Francis has been so supportive of my album. I mean, and you know, this guy's done everything. He's played with Robert Plant. He's had number ones in the States. He's, you know, he's a brilliant songwriter and musician. And yet I'm struggling like hell to get people to hear it, you know. It's because I don't have a record company behind me or a promoter. And, you know, my dilemma is if I could only get more people to hear it, you know, because I think the songs kind of do the rest. But it's tough. It's really tough. So I think the other I just thought, while we're on about Knopfler being in Yorkshire, I heard another story from that guy, which is great. He was working at the Yorkshire Post, and he was kind of a junior reporter. And the chief editor called him into his room, and he said, "Hey, Mark," he said, "you're a musician, aren't you?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "Good." He said, "There's a really famous guitarist that's died in London. He's called Jimi Henderson. Can you go down and do a report on him?" And that was the day Hendrix died.
So we've talked a lot about Mark. But for our next track in the gallery, New Zealand website Stuff singles out In the Gallery as a strong example of David Knopfler's role in the band in these first two albums. They call him the secret strength and silent star of the early Dire Straits, crucial to the magic of the band's first two albums. He was overshadowed by his older brother, but he played the perfect rhythm guitar role. Listen to In the Gallery for a great example of his jazzy voicings underneath the lead line, his support of the bass and drums, locking in as a rhythm guitarist should, being part of the rhythm section. Do you kind of agree with that assessment of David's rhythm guitar, particularly on a track like In the Gallery?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I don't think Mark would have had David in the band if he couldn't cut it, or, you know. I think it's obvious that Mark was a really ambitious guy, and, you know, I think everybody was on the top of the game in that first lineup. You know, sometimes bands, you just look out, you just get the right guys. And, you know, everyone's equal, and so yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, when you hear an album, you don't really know who's doing what. So I'd always assume that maybe Mark was doing all the guitars and David was just doing the live stuff, but obviously not. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I found it really interesting when we started chatting a few weeks ago to kind of decide what album we'd talk about today. That you had said, between the first four Dire Straits albums, now the first two, of course, are the only ones with David on them.
Yeah.
Do you think that the band lost something when David chose to leave the band? I know you've said once we get to kind of the stadium era, that maybe things start to go awry a little.
It lost me there. You know, the thing is, it's hard to put that much focus on David's departure because I feel like the albums were growing. You know, you started to get tracks like Telegraph Road that I don't know how long it is, maybe 10 minutes long or something, or 8 minutes long. I felt like I was on a journey with Knopfler. You know, he did Dire Straits, and then he did Communique after that? Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then by the time you get to Making Movies, I mean, there were a couple of songs on there, you know, Les Boys and stuff like that, that maybe were a bit throwaway. But you know, Tunnel of Love, Romeo and Juliet, Scared Away, Espresso Love, Solid Rock. I mean, just the material was so good. One of my favourite tracks is Lady Rider, actually, from Communique, which also is that kind of, I would call it, it's kind of like a Sultan's pastiche, if you will, just from the way the chords are and the guitar playing. But I was on a journey with him there, and I think I peaked at Telegraph Road, I think, at Love Over Gold, which had Telegraph Road on it. And after that, I think Brothers in Arms came. And then he went on to a Les Paul. And that's, I mean, you know, that's, the songs are still amazing, but it definitely felt like something changed big time when he came to Brothers in Arms. But the first So David left after Communique, yeah, I guess, yeah. And then Making Movies was probably Mark doing all the guitars, I would imagine. And I remember, you know, I would have loved to have been in Dire Straits, obviously, but I remember him taking a guy who worked in Manny's in New York, who he befriended as a guitar tech, you know. And I think when David left, I think he asked that guy to just, do you want to join the band? So he went from, you know, working in Manny's to touring stadiums with Dire Straits, which was a pretty nice gig.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. So we'll move on to our next track, which is Wild West End.
Yeah.
Apparently written by Mark after he watched a girl cross the road at Shaftesbury Avenue in London.
Yeah.
Online blog Songs About Places calls Wild West End quite a multi-layered song. The lazy summer mood and the sound of Mark's national guitar gives a feel of strolling down the main street of a small North Carolina town.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole song mythologizes the ordinary in the manner of Bruce Springsteen. Has Mark ever discussed his thoughts on Bruce Springsteen and if he was inspired by him at all?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I was gigging on Saturday and I was talking to the young guy who plays sax, and he's in some kind of Bruce Springsteen tribute act show. They play pretty big. They play like theatres and stuff. They're pretty good. Mm. Which brought us on to talking about his keyboard player, Roy Bittan. He's the guy who played all the intro on stuff like Tunnel of Love, and he's on the Making Movies album, and definitely on Love Over Gold. So you can really hear that that kind of playing. So I think he was very influenced by it. Springsteen, very, because, you know, he borrowed his keyboard player. So, I mean, you can't get more. He must have been checking him out. Like, you know.
So I got a real kind of romanticised feel of London. I mean, I've only visited London a few times, but I got this really romanticised feel of what London must have been like in the 70s from this song. Yeah. And it almost reminded me, we did Joni Mitchell's Blue a few months ago, and it really reminded me of the same way that she sang about California on that album. Yeah. Is this almost kind of this romantic reminiscence, is that unique to this song, or is that something that Mark would return to later on?
What a good question. First off, I'd like to say the reason I love that song and why I described it, when I said earlier tonight that you know, you feel like you're sat in a cafe looking out the window. I guess maybe it was this song I should have been referring to, but you know, when I was 17, I'd just got my driver's license. Me and a mate, we'd get up. We'd make sandwiches and a thermos, and we'd drive down to London during the night, drive down the M1, and wait for the music stores to open. And you'd sit there in your car at 6 in the morning. You'd see the city come to life, you know, the trucks delivering groceries and supplies for the cafes and stuff, and cafes opening. And, you know, you'd see a city come to life. And so when I hear that song, it just transports me back to being a 17-year-old kid and, you know, hanging out on Denmark Street and going in all the music stores and, you know, falling asleep at lunch because we're so tired, you know. So I think he's always, you know, Portobello Bell, that's got to be about, you know, maybe that is the same woman thinking about it as it could be. It could have been sat on Portobello Road, maybe. Just one more thing about this guy I was talking about, the keyboard player from Springsteen's band. He was actually the guy who played on all the Meatloaf stuff as well, the Bad Out of Hell stuff.
He did, yeah.
So I'm guessing, and that's pretty much the same, maybe 2 years earlier than Sultan's album came out.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a connection there.
So we'll move on to our final track, which is Lions.
Yeah.
Mark said of this one, "I wrote this just off Trafalgar Square. I also think of a Ted Hughes poem comparing the idea of where are the lions as opposed to these starlings in terms of contemporary figures of strength who aren't there, who used to be there." Mm. And I guess without getting too deep about it, this idea of kind of figures of strength who aren't there anymore, that's the sort of thing that resonates as strongly now as it did in the late 70s when he wrote the song.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah.
So we've discussed a lot how musically Dire Straits were nothing like their contemporaries at the time. Mm. And that's perhaps what makes this album so timeless. Do you think the lyrical content of songs like Lions helps the album from feeling dated, like many albums sadly fall into after 10 or 20 years?
Definitely. I think if you've got universal themes that are vague enough to be you know, interpreted in, you know, slightly different ways, I don't think you can go wrong, you know. I think, and that is the art of his songwriting, that, that he can packet things in, you know, present things that are, touch so many people. I mean, that's the hard thing. Writing a simple pop song is probably the hardest thing in the world. It's probably easier to write something like, you know, some prog thing than to write a simple pop song that has depth, you know. And all these songs have such depth that it's... And like I say, I don't think he set out to write hits. And I think that's a big part of this album, that they're just great songs. And they have such depth to them that you don't get tired of, you know, you don't get tired of them. Yeah, a lot of songs these days, and these songs don't have that many chords, but a lot of songs these days, you know, there's two chords going round and round, or three, and it just, and everything is in time. There's no groove, you know, it just gets really tiring to hear it. You know, your ears get tired because they're being fed with the same quantized beat, and, you know, that's why Pick Withers was so important to this album, because he had a groove. And, you know, just speeding up a little bit when you're going into a chorus and slowing down and coming out of it, that's what makes music magic, you know, for me anyway. So, you know, I did that. I've used drum machines and programming for years, but when I did my own album, it was really important to just use real drummers. And I'm so glad I did now. You know, it's organic sound.
So we'll take one more visit back to the website Stuff, who sum up the album perfectly for me with the following. It makes no attempt to acknowledge punk, to understand any of the musical ideas that were hip or bubbling up from under. It makes no bones about standing out on its own as a version of country, a version of blues, a version of folk, and a version of rock that is twisted and rolled together. That is, in fact, some weird British version of an Americana, one that didn't actually exist and hasn't since the album. It is its own thing, of its own creation and its own time. So with that in mind, why do you think that this album, Dire Straits, stands the test of time?
I mean, this is a personal question for me, because you could ask this question to many different people and probably get, you know, 10 people and get 10 different answers. This is very personal and stands the test of time for me, because it does remind me of a time in my life where I was growing up and I was really happy and new music was very exciting. You know, it's, there's so much music produced today that in a way, you know, it's really special when an album like this came along. There weren't that many albums of this quality. You know, they used to say, if you can get three good tracks on an album, you're fine. You know, that's all you need. Whereas on this album, I don't think I could pick any songs to leave off it, which is a great testament to the, you know, the quality of the album. And I mean, I don't mind looking back. You know, when you say that it reflects a bygone time, I don't mind that. I think we need to treasure our memories, and you know, I'd love to. I'd love to stand in front of that jukebox in that pub again and hear it for the first time. You know, that would be so cool. I think for me personally, if I had to go to a desert island, this one I could take with me and know that, you know, I could play it on repeat without throwing myself in the sea.
And this is the question we ask everyone at the end: why is Dire Straits your classic album? And I know you've touched a bit on that already, and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
If you haven't checked it out, I mean, it's classic for me in as much as it came along at the right time when I was learning to play guitar. It was very inspirational guitar-wise. Also, maybe something not many people talk about, you know, Knopfler as the bass player from the Stones, Bill Wyman, once said, you know, when they said, what about your vocals? He said, well, you know, I'm not exactly Pavarotti, but I sing a bit. You know, Knopfler has his, such a distinct vocal style. And it's, you know, he's not Steve Perry from Journey, but it works so good for the songs. And I think he used his, he used what he had to 100% effectiveness, kind of thing. So basically, inspirational, came along at the right time, great songs, universal subjects that we could all relate to, and yeah, it was at a time when we got to remember that you played vinyl, and it was a big cover, and you could see, you know, all that stuff played into it too, and the vinyl smelled good. And then you had a cassette for your car as well, or you record it onto a cassette and put it in your car. You know, it's just such a romantic time music-wise for me that, you know, I loved it and still love the album. And I followed him, you know, I mean, I followed his film work as well. I think it's he's an amazing composer. I've never met him, actually, but I've met Rudy from Rudy's Music, who's a really good friend of him. And, you know, he always says what a great guy he is. So, yeah.
Well, Quint, thank you very much
thank you.
For joining
thank
me
you.
Today.
Thank you. It's been, yeah. It's been good to look back and reminisce. And, you know, who knows, I might come home now and get down the studio and write a song.
Yeah, that'd be great. Just before you go, I thought it'd be cool to have an opportunity to talk a little bit about your
sure,
album, Ghost
I'd
in
love
My
to.
Heart. Yeah, so kind of where can people get that, and are there any plans for you to come over to the UK again?
Yep, I'm going to be... I don't have any gigs set up as yet, but I'm going to put together a little tour probably around March. First off, to find out more about my stuff, I have a website, and it's quintstarkey.net. Starkey with K-I-E on the end, quintstarkey.net. The easiest place to find my album, if you want to download it, is on Bandcamp. Just quintstarkey.bandcamp.com. You can also find it on Spotify. Go in there and follow me. Otherwise, if you want to actually purchase a CD, you can do it through my site, quintstarkey.net. And yeah, and I've got, you know, if you Google me on the net, there's loads of videos up and down. And so, but like I say, I've been gigging like mad. I've probably done 90 gigs this year, plugging it, and I always sell quite a few CDs on gigs and stuff, so it's going good. And it's, you know, Francis has been plugging it like mad, and thankfully through him, a lot of people have discovered it in England. So I've been doing quite a few house concerts there. So when I'm doing those, I post them on my site where I'm going to be. Most of them have been up in around the northwest. So, but I will be going down to London next year, and I've got one booked in Germany as well. So. And that's another thing. If anybody likes the stuff and you know, they want me to come and play in their house or do a house concert, just drop me a mail on the site and sort it out.
So a huge thanks to Quint Starkey there for taking time to sit down and talk about his classic album with me, the self-titled debut album from Dire Straits. And I always think it's interesting when we do debut albums. Obviously, we did Arctic Monkeys a few months ago. That, you know, it, in some ways, the story of the album is the story of the band coming together and that road to success. And that's very much the case with this album. And the songs you hear on it, you know, they're very different to what you would hear later in their career when they became this kind of stadium-conquering band. But I happen to think that I maybe prefer this kind of Dire Straits, the earlier stuff. That's just my opinion anyway. Quint, as he said, has released his debut album, Ghost in My Heart, which is available at quintstarkey.net. And you can listen to it, stream it, buy it. You know, it is a great album. I couldn't recommend it more. And he's constantly touring. I mean, Quint Starkey is a very, very busy man. And as he said, he does private events. So, you know, if you listen to his album and you decide that you kind of really like him, get in touch with him because he does do these private events. And that's really kind of intimate and special. And I know he said he's going to try and get into the UK next year, back in on tour. So absolutely check out Quint Starkey, and everything you need to know about the album and him, you can find it at quintstarkey.net. Right, so that'll just about do it. Another year of My Classic Album. I can't believe how quickly this year's gone. But I'll be back in the new year with more fantastic guests talking about fantastic classic albums. So until then, I've been Mike Norris, and have a lovely Christmas and a great new year. Cheers.